the most defining aspect of the teenage year is the shift from caring so much about what parents think to what peers think, what we often call peer pressure. I recently had the opportunity to work with a number of different schools trying to address challenges they were having with their adolescents in 7th, 8th grade, or in high school. And this was exciting. It was actually very challenging because I haven't done that much work with those years of the developmental stages of life. And it really got me thinking a lot about what is happening for the adolescent experience. And as always, trying to think about it through the lens of attachment theory. And that coincided perfectly with the episode that we were up to in the Attached Life podcast series, because here we are after discussing the newborn stage and then the early toddler stage and then talking about the stage that comes after that as a young child and then the preteen years, and now we're up to early adolescence. And that's exactly what this episode is about, trying to understand the teenager that might still be alive and struggling within ourselves and how that teenager might be affecting us as an adult. How we can nurture him or her to help us in our adult lives become the person and live the relationships that we so deeply want. This episode is sponsored anonymously, Le'ilay Nishmas Ahuva Bas Shlomo. Relationships are too important and too challenging to take for granted. Welcome to The Attached Life, where we, for many people, the teenage years can be some of the most challenging years. For many parents, their child's teenage years can be some of the most challenging years. Some people even like to say that adolescence is a temporary stage of insanity. I've recently been to a number of schools in different places in the country, all struggling with very similar challenges with teenagers. All the different phases and stages of our lives are fraught with different challenges and different nuances that make that particular part of our lives or that particular moment and phase of our lives filled with both opportunity, but also with its own unique struggles. But it's well known, famously or infamously, that the teenage years are particularly challenging. And I want to try and talk a little bit about why that is. Because if we're on this journey of trying to understand our own development with a little bit more insight, a little bit more understanding, and hopefully therefore a little bit more compassion and the ability to heal our inner selves, to connect with, possibly meet for the first time, some of the parts of us that have been living inside of us for many years, and to form a relationship between our adult self and those younger selves, to gain more perspective and compassion, to help raise those parts of us that have struggled. We need to understand what was going on for us in those teenage years. So as usual, this episode might be helpful for parents raising teenagers. And if that's a secondary benefit to this content, then I'm very happy about that. But the intended goal and the primary goal is for us to understand ourselves, looking back and looking inwards at this stage of adolescence. What some of the more recent neuroscientists have been arguing, I think, is very compelling. In particular, someone named Dan Siegel, who's very worth reading and listening to. If you find any of his work, he has a lot of different work that he did. One of his particular areas is he wrote a book on the teenage year. He and others argue this point from a evolutionary perspective. That's not the perspective I'm going to argue for it from. But there is a truth, I think, or an insight, a perspective to what he's saying that stands on its own regardless of looking at it from an evolutionary perspective or not. And that is that the reason the teenage brain can seem like a phase of temporary insanity is not because there's actually something wrong with it or something insane, quote-unquote, about it, but it's because the teenage brain is actually going through a phase of remodeling. What that means to say is that one of the recent discoveries in the brain is what's called neuroplasticity. And that's the idea that our brain is always developing. It is always able to reform in a variety of different ways. But there are stages or times when that neuroplasticity, that development of the brain, is more acute, or there's more fundamental changes being made. And that's certainly true in early years of life, as we've spoken about. But it's also true, again, in a very particular and poignant way, in a very deep way, during the adolescent years. Another way to think about it is that adolescence is a phase of remodeling, of the brain remodeling itself, which means that the brain is going through a reconstruction. And all reconstruction, all new construction, requires first, if it's taking place in an area which something already exists, then construction is going to require some level of destruction first. There's first going to need to be some sort of clearing of what's there in order to then build something new. And that process of clearing away and then building something new is what the neuroscience seems to show is happening during the adolescent years. There's actually a pruning, as he calls it. There's a pruning of the brain. It's like a tree that grew branches and leaves and fruit. And now we want the tree to grow back to grow something new in a more powerful or intense way. And so we prune, we start to cut off the edges of it and allow it to then grow back. But in that process, there's a sort of deconstructing that takes place. And it might look like it's a process of losing potency and losing life and losing insight and productivity and losing the capacity to function in such a wholesome or healthy way. But what's actually happening is that there's some form of a deconstruction that's happening for the sake of something even more impressive and more powerful being constructed. Now, why is the brain going through a remodeling period at this time of adolescence? What's argued is that in the early years of our life, until early adolescence, our primary attachment, because if we think again from the fundamental perspective that we are talking about in this podcast, which is looking at life through the lens of attachment, that our most fundamental, primary, basic, and ultimately fulfilling need is our attachments, it's our relationships. From the moment we're born, from the moment we exist in connection to others, and we exist with the deepest desire to live in connection with others. So in the early years of our lives, our attachment is to our primary caregivers. So let's say to our parents. We have attachment as we get older, even in young years of childhood, to peers, to teachers, to other relatives, to siblings. But our primary, most fundamental attachment is to our parents. But the attachment needs that we have are, as John Bowlby said, the founding father of attachment theory, they're from cradle to grave. It means they go for the entire lifespan of a person. So in those early years, the attachment is to our parents. But when we become an adult, our primary attachment is going to become to a spouse, to a romantic partner, a romantic attachment. We really have fundamentally the same attachment needs as a newborn baby or as a child that we do to somebody that we're dating or someone that we're married to, someone we're in a serious relationship with. It's just a shift of who the attachment is met from. And there are, of course, some nuanced changes and some important changes, sometimes big changes in the nature of what that attachment relationship looks like. But fundamentally, it's the same need for attachment that exists from our parents and is then going to shift over into a spouse, into an intimate partner. In order for that shift to happen, we need to go through a change process, a transition that is in some way almost cataclysmic. It's massive. It's existentially challenging. Because if you think about it, if a person has a healthy attachment, has secure attachment, even if they have insecure attachment, their whole fundamental stability, the earth that they stand on, figuratively and literally, the base of their whole being is their attachment to their caregivers. So how is that ever going to change? Why would that ever change? Why would a person ever stop wanting to receive all the attachment needs that they have to feel safe, to feel soothed, to feel seen, to feel supported, to feel provided for, to feel connected to feel valued, to feel loved, to feel wanted? They're getting all of that, let's say, from their parents in one way or another. They might be getting it well and they might not be getting it well, but even if they're not getting it well, that's where they're getting it from. So why would that ever change? Why would that ever shift over? But as they become an adult, that's what's going to need to happen. It's going to need to, in a sense, detach from those primary attachment figures in order to be able to attach to a new primary attachment figure, namely a peer. It's going to need to shift from that primary attachment figure of the parents to somehow now become a spouse, a significant other, another adult, someone who's a peer. So in order for that to happen, the brain needs to do something radical. It needs to develop something completely different than it had before. And in order to do that, it needs to go through what might look on the outside like a temporary phase of insanity, because it's remodeling. The brain is going through a preparatory period, preparing itself to leave home. We're not talking about fully disconnecting or detaching from those primary caregivers. Those attachments can remain for life, and they so fundamentally need to throughout the teenage years and even in adult years. The connection to parents is so vital and so fundamental for well-being during and throughout all those years. But the brain is remodeling itself in order to shift from the childhood attachment to parents to then develop a new attachment to a future spouse, a future significant other. And the in-between phase that it goes through is the seeking of attachment to peers, to friend groups. But in order to do that, the brain needs to do a number of things that really can, again, from the outside, look crazy and maddening and make other people looking at a teenager think that this person has lost it. They've lost their mind, because actually their mind is pruning and remodeling, and something in the mind has been lost. But what's been lost has been lost for the sake of something much greater developing. So in order to do this, because again, if we think about how radical this change is, the brain needs to develop the desire for something that almost feels risky. It needs to develop a thrill-seeking, risk-seeking reward center. And so the reward center in the brain, often thought of called dopamine, is going to release much more of its reward feedback in the adolescent years for things that are risky. Because if you think about what the brain is doing, is that it's fundamentally doing something risky. It is transitioning out of its safe attachment into an unknown territory to discover new attachment. In order to empower that process to happen, the brain needs to become comfortable and actually desiring of risk. And so we look at teenagers and we look at them and sometimes think, how could they be doing this? Why would they be doing this? This makes no sense for them to be doing. This is crazy. And the answer is that's actually exactly why they're doing it. They also need to have a much more heightened, the brain is developing a much more intense experience of emotionality, of emotional drive, and a much more intense sense of independent thinking and questioning whatever we have received, questioning whatever we were given. Because again, all of that is what sets the stage for the transition from being a child at home being taken care of to becoming an adult that can function on his or her own. It's all part of a remodeling process that is a preparation for leaving home. And the most intense part of this whole thing is the experience of beginning to focus more and more on peers. And so as everyone knows, the most defining aspect of the teenage year is the shift from caring so much about what parents think to really caring a tremendous amount about what peers think, what we often call peer pressure. And the reason for this, when we think about this whole process from the perspective we're talking about now, makes so much sense. Because the teenager is doing exactly this. The teenage brain is trying to shift away from the home base to a new attachment that he or she is going to find and is going to develop with peers. And then ultimately with one particular peer in building their own sacred, exclusive, and powerful attachment. But in the process of doing this, there's a shift to now caring a great deal about what my peers think of me. So if for the teenager, what their new focus becomes is attachment to peers, because our whole most essential experience of safety in this world is through attachment. And so initially our attachments to parents, but now our attachments becoming to peers. From that perspective, we can understand well why a teenager will talk as if it's a life or death experience for them to have the same pair of shoes or belt or shirt or brand or phone or go to the same camp or party or whatever it is that their friends and peers are doing. They talk about it as if this is a life or death thing, even though sometimes the adults look at them and say, well, what's the big deal? Or everyone else is just giving into peer pressure. Why do you have to give into peer pressure? Why can't you think for yourself? Why do you have to be like everybody else? Or can't you see why this is a terrible idea? Or this is dangerous. You can't do this. And yet for the teenager, they're talking about it as if it's just a necessity. They have to. And from this perspective, we can understand that actually, in fact, it is. From their perspective, I shouldn't say it is, but on some level it is. It really is in their mind at that moment, on some level, a life or death experience to be like others, to fit in with others, because attachment is a basic need of life. It is a life or death proposition to have attachment. And if their attachment is now becoming attachment to peers, so then fitting in with their peers and acceptance from their peers becomes almost a life or death experience for them. And that's why we see these kind of radical behaviors that seem so illogical and irrational from peers to just fit in, to just be like everybody else at all costs. And that peer pressure can actually trump and overtake any sort of moral or safe or rational thinking, because attachment needs are our most basic needs, and their attachment needs become connected to their peers. But if you think about all these changes that are happening, the increased need for connection to peers, which feels much more risky than the attachment they already had and developed at home, and you think about the high levels of release of dopamine that come from risk-taking and novelty, and you think about the remodeling that's taking place, the questioning, the new sense of some independence, the heightened level of emotion, the intensity of emotion. If you think about all that going on, what unfolds or what becomes clear is something very paradoxical. Because if all of that remodeling is going on, that means the teenager is going through something that actually is so fragile, so unstable, so insecure, so shaky. There isn't firm, solid ground underneath them. So when in a person's life do they need that parental, solid figure more than any other time? In some way, it's actually during these years exactly. During the teenage years when such a fundamental and scary remodeling is going on. And yet the whole remodeling is that I need less of you and I need more peers. But in that experience, I need you more than ever. And that's why there can sometimes be with the teenage years this really difficult love-hate relationship with parents. Because I specifically don't want you right now. And in my not wanting you, I need you more than ever. And it creates this very confusing dance sometimes that can create a lot of issues. So these are some of the core characteristics of what's going on naturally and in a healthy way during the teenage years. And then the question becomes, how do the caregivers respond to all of this going on? If the parents respond in a way of shaming these behaviors, why are you so intent on being like everyone else? Why do you have to do this? It doesn't make sense. That you know better than that's not what you should be doing. It's not that big of a deal to not go to this one thing that everyone else is going to. Why can't you just accept what we're telling you to do? If the parent is shaming of these different things, of the heightened emotionality, if the parent is expressing their critique or their rerouting or their correcting of the behaviors of the teenager in a way that's not about just the behaviors, but it feels shaming of where it's coming from, then the teenager is actually going through a process that they have no control over and is happening naturally and for good reason, but they're feeling a sense of shame around it, which means that they're now going to identify themselves as bad, as wrong, as something wrong, as opposed to a parent who gives the space for the teenager to go through this process, which then allows the teenager to actually want the parents' support. Because remember, the teenager specifically wants space from the parent to develop new attachments to peers. But in doing that, they so deeply want the parents' support, which means they want the parents' support in a way that is supportive on almost a meta level. That I know the parent is there, I know that they care, I know that they're aware, and I know that I can fall back on them, but I don't want them involved in every detail of my life. And even when the parent does have to get involved in details, because the parent does still have a responsibility to make sure that the child is safe and that they're making as good decisions as possible in the context, so then the question is, how does the parent do it? Do they do that? Do they get involved in a way that is shaming of the teenager's newfound nature and their remodeling process? Or do they do it in a way that allows the teenager to feel that, yes, of course, it makes sense that you're feeling this way, that you're wanting this, that this is so important to you, that you're experiencing this in such an intense and powerful way? All of that makes good sense. Now we have to figure out what to do. But the fact that you're feeling and experiencing all of that makes sense. It's exactly how it's supposed to be. If the people around these teenagers can relate to this remodeling process, not as a time of you're bad, you're being bad, you're doing bad, you are insane, you are infuriating, not from that perspective, but instead looking at it from a perspective of what's talked about in Hasidus and in many different Svarim sources, Jewish texts, what's called a Yerida Letzorech Aliyah. It's a descent for the sake of ascent. It's a deconstruction that's really for the sake of constructing something greater than what was there before. And so there are many challenges and many aspects of these years of adolescence that seem to be in some way actually a regression from what existed before. But it's a regression that's there to create a further enhanced progress. Something more powerful comes out on the other side. What the neuroscience shows is that in this pruning process, aspects of the brain actually do diminish, but then they rebuild in a way that is more powerful than was there before. There's all sorts of fancy neuroscience words that have to do with this that are not my area of expertise, but talking about the cutting down of synapses that then myelinate, I think is the word, that end up creating more powerful connections and integration of the brain. But it's really this concept of Yerida Letzorech Aliyah. And when those who are around the teenager are able to be there for them in that kind of a way, as Rav Hirsch talks about, Rav Hirsch talks about in Brachos that the word for a teen, a young teen, is a na'ar. And na'ar in Hebrew means lina'er, means to shake off, to shake something off. The nature of the teenager is to try to shake off what was given to them. Similarly, the word, another word for that stage of life would be a bachar, which is from the word livchor, bechira, to choose, that the nature is to want to make choices on their own. So if we look at that as they're rebelling, they're bad, they don't listen to us, then we end up shaming that. But what we're shaming is actually what their nature, their built-in nature is. So then they identify themselves in a way that is self-identified as there's something wrong with me, there's something bad about me. Versus, no, you're exactly what you're supposed to be. You're a na'ar, you're a bachar, you're shaking off, you're choosing. Because that's the process that you need to go through, that you're supposed to be going through. So there are many aspects of adolescence that become challenging. We could spend time talking about what happens in those peer-to-peer interactions and these stages of trying to develop attachment to peers. And there's so many different aspects of physical, physiological changes that the teenager is going through. To take a moment and think about, what was that experience for me in those teenage years? What was that experience for me in terms of this crossroads, this very difficult transition, this really, in a sense, radical transition? Was I supported in that, or was I shamed in that? Hopefully, for most people, it's not an all or nothing question. There's a wide variety and there's a spectrum. But to find the ways in which I was supported and to allow myself to feel nurtured by that and nourished by that. And equally important, to find the ways in which I felt unsupported, if that's the case. The ways in which I was made to feel bad about aspects of this teenage stage. Because in those aspects, I may have developed one of two extremes in my adult lifestyle. I may have either developed what I now have as a avoidance and a rebelliousness, an avoidance of authority, an avoidance of commitment, and a rebelliousness, because if I was shamed in my stages of teenagehood, of adolescence, for being a na'ar, a bachar, for being someone who's shaking off what's there already and making choices for myself and trying to connect with peers, if I experienced a lot of claustrophobia around that, if I felt suffocated in the experience of needing to find that space, I may have been forced to find that space by rebelling. I may have been forced to find that space by lying, by being deceitful, by doing it secretly. And does any of that still exist in some way, big or small, in my adult life, in which I avoid commitment and responsibility, and I have a very hard time doing something when I know that someone else is asking me to do it? I feel this almost chronic compulsive need to just do my own thing, to do it in my own way. If someone wants me to do it, it makes it harder for me to do it. And that might be coming from that experience in the adolescent years of needing to find the space by going to the extreme. And doing it in secrecy and doing it in a way that's shame-based. The alternative is that if the teenager was shamed in that way, instead of rebelling and finding their secret space to do it, to act as a teenager, they may have actually just diminished their sense of autonomy, of personality, their sense of who they are. One of the other aspects of the pruning that happens in the brain that I didn't spend as much time talking about earlier, is that the brain in the earlier stages of life focuses on accumulating a generalized level of knowledge. And in the pruning process in the adolescent years, what's happening is that the brain is pulling back from the generalized knowledge and it's trying to develop more specificity, in a sense, more expertise, which is why teenagers can become extremely passionate or focused on certain things for certain time periods and then completely switch to something else. Because what's happening is that the teenage brain is again remodeling to shift from just being like everyone, the generalized kind of knowledge, into developing my own unique personality. But if in doing that, if in becoming my own personalized self, I'm really shamed around that and I'm not given the ability to do that, then that may have made me just shut down and stop looking for that and not try for that anymore. And that's where some adults, instead of the more rebellious, secretive side that I discussed before, instead you have the adults who are lacking in their ability to have self-expression, lacking in their ability to advocate or assert themselves, to have their unique personality, to be who they really could be. And so in either of those instances, what we want to do, as we've talked about in so many contexts in previous episodes, is we want to go back and find that younger teenager that exists within ourself, that is still feeling shamed for going through this remodeling process. And we want to help to unshame that teenager, to have a conversation with him or with her about what's going on for them, to hear from them the way they were being parented or treated or responded to and how that affected them, how that hurt them, how that shamed them, how that led to certain behaviors of either acting out or shutting down. And we want to help them imagine what they needed, what it could have been like, what would have been different, and then imagine the experience of it being different. Imagine the experience of the fantasy, idealized version of what the parental parenting would have been, what it would have looked like, how they would have been raised, how they would have been spoken to, how their behaviors would have been responded to, how their crazy teenage brain would have been spoken to, so that it didn't have to feel like I'm crazy, there's something wrong with me, but instead I'm just being exactly how I'm supposed to be, going through a process that actually is quite challenging, and I'm just doing the best I can. And how I can be supported in that, because in that process I do still need support. But I need the support to come in a way that feels nurturing and feels helpful. So to open that dialogue and that relationship between my adult self and my teenage self, to help strengthen the muscles that were underdeveloped, to help nurse the wounds in those years that were created. And when we do this, hopefully as an adult, we can then be able to engage the relationships with ourselves, with others, with God, in the way that the teenage brain was trying to remodel in order to accomplish. But if it was stagnant, if it was blocked in the remodeling process, if it wasn't given the space to remodel, then maybe that's a part of why we never really got to the adult relationships that we really so deeply want to have. And if we help, really deeply help and see that teenager and allow them the opportunity, even now, 10 years later, 20 years later, 50 years later, we help them now have the space for that remodeling to finally complete itself, then we might be able to see the adult that we are today experiencing the relationships that all of the remodeling was really aimed and striving to be able to actualize in our lives.